The Good, the Mad and the Ugly takes a light-hearted look at what author Peter Dron considers to be in the golden age of motoring journalism, the last two decades of the 20th century. As a writer and tester for Motor Magazine, founding editor of Fastlane Magazine, and a freelance journalist with a weekly column in the Daily Telegraph, Peter has many tales to tell. He meets industry moguls, unusual motoring journalists, and various other passers-by. To tell us more about the golden age of motoring journalism, delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere in the south of France, author of The Good, the Mad and the Ugly, Peter Dron. Peter, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, well, pleasure. The pleasure is all my... Whereabouts are you? Are you in Monaco, in Nice? Whereabouts have we found you? Somewhere in the south of France?
I'm 30 miles north of Saint-Maxime.
Which is somewhere...
Which is close to Saint-Tropez.
And that's a very good place for a motoring journalist to be, I would imagine.
It is, actually. I'm at about 500 metres altitude, and there are a lot of frequently used test roads around here. At the moment, there's the launch of the new Ford Mustang going on just a few miles from where I live.
Superb. So tell me a little bit about why you, in your book, The Good, the Mad and the Ugly, not to mention Jeremy Clarkson, you think that the last two decades of the 20th century were the golden age for motoring journalists.
Well, when I joined Motor Magazine in 1976, there were some really bad cars on the market, and immediately after that, there were huge improvements in tyres, brakes, handling, engine performance, and reliability. And cars became really mechanically superb. And at the same time, being a motoring journalist for leading magazines or newspapers was great fun, as well as hard work. And now I think it's just mostly hard work. I think a lot of the fun has gone out of it. But I feel very privileged to have lived through that period and to have worked through that period, and which is sort of gone now.
I mean, would you say that the motoring journalists, perhaps in the sort of the 80s and the 90s and almost the first bit of the noughties, had a sort of esprit de corps? You were all together, no matter if you were doing a press launch for Volkswagen or something for Fiat. I mean, they were busting you all around the world and flying around the place, and everything was all inclusive.
Well, I think there is some truth in that, going on a car launch was great fun, because you'd fly out somewhere, you'd drive the car for 2 or 3 hours, and then you'd spend an evening in a five-star hotel, and you can't complain about that. But during the evening, you had the chance to speak to engineers, designers, various people connected with the car manufacturer, and also to spread a lot of gossip in the bar afterwards with friends. But it was and then the next day you'd drive for 2 or 3 hours more. But I always felt that if I didn't come away with a secondary story, and the primary story being the new car that one was testing, but if you didn't come away with the secondary story, you'd sort of missed out somehow. So it was a great opportunity. But now I understand that the journalists now, they eat their food very quickly, and they shoot it away to their rooms and hammer out copy, because everything has to be done yesterday. And I'm sure they're missing out not only on a lot of fun, but on some interesting information.
Mm, the problem is, of course, is the fact that it's the interweb thing, isn't it? It's got to be there yesterday. It's got to be quicker than...
That's it. It's got it's brought a lot of advantages, but it's destroyed a lot of other things.
No, I mean, if you remember correctly, when there used to be sort of a cue car or something, you know, an undercover car going out there, and it was spotted on the N25, you would pick up a copy of Motor or something and say, you know, we think we've seen the latest BMW, we think we've seen Vauxhall's answer to whatever it was coming out of, wherever it was, that would break a front cover of a magazine. Now, of course, somebody's got, you know, going down the N25, sees something, or a back road in Surrey or whatever, an Autostrada outside Milano, takes a picture of it, and next thing you know, it's gone. So what was it like then? Because you said you joined, you started writing about cars in the late 70s. Now, those of us with long enough memories will remember that this was an interesting period, so we say, for the British car industry. We'd had the golden days of the 60s. We'd had, you know, cars yep. like MG. We'd had the Hunter, you know, the Roots Group. We had all these great independent car makers all being amalgamated. And the 70s was a bit of a nightmare in terms of British motoring.
Well, it was, because in the early 1950s, there were something like 60 British car manufacturers, and there was a possibility for example, Rover could have become what BMW became, and in fact, it could have taken over BMW at one point, I think, but... And Rovers were really good, but that amalgamation into BLMC and it became Austin Rover and so on, that was an absolute disaster for the quality side below Jaguar and Rolls Royce and all that stuff, but quality stuff that could have competed with BMW and Mercedes and Audi and so on. And in fact, I've got a story about an interview in the book with Donald Stokes, Lord Stokes. And actually, it wasn't really all his fault.
Donald Stokes, Lord Stokes was the man in charge at British Leyland, wasn't he?
He was, yes, yeah. And he probably wasn't the right man at the right time, but I don't know who could have been. And the trouble is that the BL people, the Austin Morris side of it, they had an inbuilt attitude just to get product out as fast as possible, and they left the quality side of it out. Whereas the Germans became obsessed with quality, and that's why they succeeded.
And you met two of the most iconic figures in the German motor industry, the head of BMW, and were you described as perhaps the most interesting man or enigmatic man you ever met?
Yes, the head of the Volkswagen Group, Ferdinand Piëch, and he, I think he's the only figure who stands out from the second half of the 20th century. He stands in comparison with Henry Ford and Louis Renault, you know, the pioneers. He was a great engineer. He was the principal engineer of the Porsche 911 and also the 917 racer. But he was also rather mad. And I sat next to him at dinner, and he was quite charming. But I really wouldn't want to work for someone like him, because even in a relaxed atmosphere like that, he had mad staring eyes. And I once began a report in the Daily Telegraph, and it went something like this: when Dr. Piëch cracks a joke, his senior managers are never sure whether to laugh or to bite into their cyanide capsules. I was told afterwards by a senior Volkswagen executive that that cutting from the Telegraph was pinned up on the notice board in the press office in Wolfsburg, which is the Volkswagen headquarters. But they always hid it in a drawer when Piëch was going to visit.
What was it? I mean, the German motor industry as well from the 70s. I mean, compared to the chaos that was British Leyland, I mean, the German motor industry, you mentioned Porsche, you mentioned Volkswagen, and you mentioned BMW, was a streamlined machine that, you know, obviously the British Leyland could only hope to emulate.
They have had this obsession to dominate and so on. And Piëch actually he was responsible for Volkswagen's success, but also for its disaster with the emissions testing scandal, because I'm sure he didn't know about the cheating system that got the cars through the emissions tests, but he created such a climate of fear that his senior managers felt obliged to do whatever they could to meet what he was demanding, because the alternative was being fired. So he was the man responsible. There's no doubt, I think.
So tell me a little bit about the difference between somebody like them, then, and when you go to look at, you know, you go to see the latest thing coming out of the showroom or coming out of the factory of Volkswagen or BMW, and when you get to have, you get the invite to come down to Italy to check out the latest Ferrari or the latest Lamborghini or something else beautiful coming out, beautiful yet unreliable from Alfa Romeo. I mean, did you look forward to those trips more than perhaps, heading down the Autobahn?
Well, I think you're being a bit unfair on Alfa Romeo, because one of my favourite cars was one of the first, after I became freelance, I had to buy a car, which was the first time for many years, and the car I bought was an Alfa Romeo 75, and actually that was the first Alfa Romeo that left the factory not already rusting, very nicely engineered in most ways, and you could do things to the suspension to make it better. And I actually enjoyed more driving a car of that type with 140, 150 horsepower, and not too wide tyres and so on. I mean, it's fine driving the Ferraris and Lamborghinis and so on, and it's really good fun. But and the other day I was following a Lamborghini on slightly damp roads around here. I was in my Honda Civic, and the guy was driving very well, but I could keep up with him easily. And even though he had four wheel drive, but he's got big fat wide tyres, and those cars are absolutely hopeless in those conditions. So you can have much more fun with a less powered car.
Tell me a little bit about what goes on or what you look forward to most when you get, okay, it's the Geneva Motor Show, it's the Turin Motor Show. I mean, how do you approach a motor show? I mean, obviously when you go for a car launch, you're just looking at one mark. But when it comes When it comes to something like the Geneva Motor Show, it must be tremendous fun, but tremendous hard work, and it must be sort of running around madly during the day, and then, shall we say, relaxing at full pelt in the evening?
It's like the we were discussing car launches and the hotels. It was great fun, and again, hard work. I need to finish up absolutely exhausted and sort of 5-6 o'clock in the afternoon after arriving there at 8 and just walking all over the place and talking to people and listening to them and so on, and then you'd join a queue to get back from the traffic jam to get back into the city and park, and then there were invitations to dinner, and there was a Fiat used to have a boat moored on the quay there, and everybody was invited, and even when people like the car designers weren't invited, they managed to get on, and everybody got completely plastered, and it was jolly, it really was jolly good fun, yes. But it isn't anymore.
It isn't anymore. It's all business. Do you think that perhaps, I mean, I'm looking at the chapters of the book, which are legendary. I think they've got some of the best. I mean, I'll come to some of them in a minute. But the first chapter of the book starts with the one not about Jeremy Clarkson chapter. Do you think perhaps that motoring, I mean, when you think about, motoring magazines, Before Top Gear took the unsuspecting world by storm. I mean, Top Gear before Clarkson and Hammond and James May came on, it was very, Tiffany Dell was presenting, it was very much about axles and stuff like that, and they took it and turned it into a celebrity show.
Yes, exactly. It was a motoring program, and, people can like or dislike Jeremy, but and you can like or dislike the old Top Gear, and it's the same as with the Grand Tour now. And I never liked either of those programs much, but except for a few episodes. But people think of Jeremy as a motoring journalist, and he's not really. He's a television personality, and he's a natural. He's a showman, I'd like to have some of his millions, I must say.
But, 30 million at last count, I believe it was.
Well, yeah, 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 I wouldn't mind some of that, but I'd really dislike being that famous, so it must be quite unpleasant, I think.
But as a motoring journalist, I mean, when you go to a car launch and you're talking about, the latest Bentley, I mean, as a motoring journalist, even if you're doing a piece to radio like I do sometimes, or a piece to TV, or a piece to a YouTube channel, whatever you're doing, you know, you need to, your job is to explain the technical bits, as well as saying, you know, as Clarkson would say, you know, it handles like your grandmother's old armchair. But your job, surely, as a motoring journalist, is to, for those who want to know the nuts and bolts, they don't want to have the boy's own version, they want to have the mechanical version as well.
Yes, I always took the approach that when I was driving a car, I had to imagine the potential buyer, and to imagine and to think of the alternatives that buyer could have, what the car was aimed at doing, how well it achieved that. So, and the skill then is to present all that without being boring. That's what I always try to do anyway. It was quite a serious thing to do in the sense of I had a responsibility, I thought. To people.
Now, just looking at some of the titles of the chapter, you've won my sort of March award already for chapters of the month, because some of these, nobody messed with the electric carrot. I mean, that's something like something out of a 60s sort of acid house. I mean, what on earth is that about, please, Peter?
Well, it's about a PR man who had red hair. It's all gone grey now. It's not falling out. And he was a very dynamic character, as explained in that chapter, who got me out of trouble when I was having difficulty with the hotel reception people in Turin for the show. And he worked for Fiat, and he was such a sort of manic character because of his red hair. He was known as the Electric Carrot, or some others say it was the flying carrot, but he was a good guy.
And also, you've got up the hill with Hanu. Now, if that's the right of the Hanu I'm thinking of, that must have been quite an experience, and probably sideways.
So what was that?
You've got up the hill with Hanu. Is that Mr.
Oh, yes. That was the first Audi Quattro rally car, and this is in Portugal before its first event, and. There was a disaster for the PR man who arranged all that. It wasn't his fault at all, as I explained in the chapter. But we ended up in the middle of nowhere in complete darkness, except for these arc lights, and the mechanics were working on it. And I was the first journalist to sit alongside Hanu in the Rally Audi Quattro, and we went blasting up this. This hillside was, you know, rough track, and I kept seeing these flashing lights, and I thought we were being followed by somebody, which seemed improbable because it was going so fast. And then I realised it was the exhaust pipe came out under my door, and there was a flame about 2 feet long coming out of it.
Oh,
and every time the flame blasted out of it, I could see sort of. First of all, a 50-foot drop, and then a 100-foot drop, and then about 200-foot drop, and we got up, having gone really fast up this hill, and not as sideways as in the rear-wheel drive rally cars before that, but really, really fast, and then Hanu slowed because we were approaching a village, and I said to him, where does the road go from here? And he said, I don't know, I've never been here before.
did you sort of life flash before you at that point?
Well, just a bit, yeah.
I mean, what's it like? I mean, how do sort of rally? I mean, Hannah Mikkel, I mean, the Audi when it was unleashed on an unsuspecting rally driving world, it said it didn't break the laws of physics, it bent them double because the way that thing stuck to the road.
Well, yes, it's quite extraordinary, and I've been driven by Stig Blomqvist on snow and ice as well, and on an ice lake, he actually made Ford Cortina. It was on snow tires, but and with studs. He actually made it seem like quite a good handling car. Super driver can do, I suppose.
And what other drivers did you bump into in your? I mean, did the PRs normally give you quite a well known driver from either their rally program or their motoring program to sit there?
Well,
for...
I've met all sorts of racing drivers, famous ones, and so on. I've met, I think, 10 world champions. I've met Fangio. But there's a chapter with Mika Häkkinen in which he and I went to interview Prince Albert of Monaco, which was quite interesting.
Oh, right, okay.
I've met and been driven by several top rally drivers, Blomqvist, Nicola, Walter Rall, who is possibly the best ever.
Absolutely. All these sort of, you know, driving to and driving back from, and, you know, if you were given the car for a week or something just to get, you know, to know it quite well, any run-ins with our friends, the Boys in Blue, at all?
Sorry, any what?
Any run-ins with the Boys in Blue, the police? I mean, they must take a keen interest in you if you're...
I've got a chapter about how I escaped from them in Sussex, and this was in about 1980, and I decided this downhill S-bend could be taken flat in my Mazda RX-7, which meant sort of 125 miles an hour, something like that. This is on the lower end of the A23, after the M23, and I managed to take it flat, but just as I was coming out of this S-bend, I could see blue lights coming on the left, and just after that, I was worried that they would catch me, and that would be a big, big problem, or they'd radio ahead or something, and I'd get stuck in traffic. And just after that, there was some severe, it was steep hills and dips and so on. And in one of the dips, I braked really hard and turned sharp left along this farm track, which I knew. And the farm track, at the end of that, it was a farm, as you'd expect, and the owner of that was a Mrs. Palmer, who was the mother of Jonathan Palmer, the racing driver who now owns most of the circuits in Britain. And I turned up. I saw the blue lights carrying on down towards Brighton behind me, so I'd switched off all my lights. And I turned up at her house, and she said, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm on the run from the police. And she said, you better have a cup of tea then, dear.
Marvellous. Couple of last questions for you, I'll let you get on. But what was the best car that you were really loath to let go? And what was the car that scared you the most and thought, right, I'm glad that one's going back on its trailer?
I think the car that scared me most was a Skoda Estelle.
Really?
About 1980, and it had such terrible handling. But one of the most fun cars later on was a Skoda Rapide, and the Porsche engineers had been hired by Skoda to develop that. That was one the last of the real Skodas before they got taken over by Volkswagen, and with rear-wheel drive. And these Porsche engineers turned it into a sort of mini 911, and it was just such fun.
Oh, brilliant. The book is called The Good, the Mad, and the Ugly, not to mention Jeremy Clarkson, The Golden Years of Motoring Journalism. It's out now. Is it Veloci or Veloci Publishing? It's out.
Veloci, excuse me.
My Italian let me down, as always. Yep. It's out now. Peter, if people want to follow you, do you do the social media thing? Can they download it on the web and that sort of stuff?
Yeah, yes.
And is there what's the web? Are you peterdrawn.com, for example? What's your email?
I'm on Facebook. If you tap in Peter Drawn, and there aren't many Peter Drawns in the world, and you should get me. Mm. So I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter, and so on. And so is Veloci. So and people can get the book direct from Veloci, or by other means. But it's just a cheap from Veloci, I think.
Super.
It's only £15.
A bargain at half the price, I say. You've done your spiel there, Peter. Very well done. And it will be also available as a virtual download in the TRE virtual bookstore. Peter, only question is, after all this machinery, what are you up to next? What's your next project you're working on?
Well, I have a load of notes and anecdotes in my computer about various other incidents in my life, such as at one point in the early 1970s when I was a bit down my uppers, I took a job pumping petrol, and one of the people who came into the petrol station in Belsize Park frequently was Dudley Moore in his black Maserati.
Oh, wow.
So I've done that. And earlier than that, when I was 16, I was in Rome, and I was working in a pizza establishment, and one day these seven guys came in, and the tall one was Clint Eastwood. So I haven't actually served pasta to Clint Eastwood, but I have served pizza.
And a fierce, and that really would have been the good, the bad, and ugly, and a fistful of whatever pepperoni. The book's called The Good, the Mad, and the Ugly, not to mention Jeremy Clarkson. It's out now on Veloci Publishing. Peter Drawn, thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.